Welcome to What CEOs Want to Know, short conversations that make a lasting difference in your business. My name is Linda Ruland, founder of SuccessAuthorities.com and the producer of this podcast series. Recently, Success Authorities spoke with attorney David Silverman about mergers and acquisitions, M&A. It was a unique opportunity to discuss the challenges and successes of these complicated deals.
How do you think about culture in terms of looking at a merger acquisition?
I think about it as overlooked, not well considered, but thought of as well considered. And that's dangerous. There's a statistic out there that says something like 60 to 85%, or it was a pretty big range, M&As fail because of mismatched or inability to match cultures. And it seems so easy. If you make widgets and I make widgets, then this should be really simple. We just can make widgets together. And that never happens that way. And one of the conversations that I have with owners about this is, just think about your own personal experience. If you were making a widget in your garage, and then your neighbor comes over, and your neighbor makes widgets, but your neighbor knows everything, and there's just nothing about widget making that your neighbor doesn't know. Okay. And now it's, well, gee, this is the way I make widgets. And no, this is the way I make widgets and you should make them this way. And we're talking about two people. And now multiply that by however many people and you see the problem. The culture clash arises primarily from the lack of forethought and then the lack of adequate collaboration within your own organization, and then the lack of planning within your own organization, and then the lack of collaboration between the organizations. There's going to be a multitude of different opinions about, between all those different people. And then you have the ego problem. The culture issue requires a lack of ego. It requires some very, very thoughtful conversation starting at the top and then filtering down. Really, it is part of the pre-planning, because once you start getting into an indication of interest or a memorandum of whatever you want to call it, memorandum of understanding, though, then you're getting into specific deal points, and you cannot reduce culture to a deal point. So those things all have to be very, very well vetted.
What role would you say, and that you've experienced, that you've seen, leadership plays in a merger or an acquisition working successfully?
Whatever that leadership style is, it's not going to change for this transaction. Whatever the leadership style is during day-to-day business, that's what you're going to see during M&A. It also takes a significant amount of focus and endurance over time. And not all leaders have that ability to stay focused, because I'm running my business. An M&A deal takes a great deal of time. It takes a great deal of concentration and focus and a great deal of consistency. And those traits, among many others, are inherent to whoever the deal person, the leader is. Those are the things that, those are the kind of qualities that are just going to pass through and flow into that deal. When I, as the leader of the company, I have this whole culture that I've built around my personality. And if I need and that works operationally day in and day out, okay, that's fine. But then if I run across something that requires far more patience, far more diligence, and far more collaboration amongst the team that is not used to working slowly, patiently, diligently, and even collaboratively, now I got a problem. Think of it like a system conversion. Okay, that's almost as big as an M&A in so many ways in terms of how it impacts your day-to-day operation. If any of you have been through a system, an IT system conversion, And I've never heard of one that goes smoothly. When you watch your organization go through that, if it's an organization that's used to going step by step, methodically, one thing at a time, do it right, and then move on, great. But if you've got an organization that's used to moving at 100 miles an hour every day, it gets frustrating really quickly for everybody. And now you got to match that culture with whoever it is that you're going to merge with. And then you can see that. So it's really tough. So to bring this all back to the leader needs to be able to adjust him or herself to this kind of a lengthy transaction, because it is a lengthy transaction.
Kind of thinking back on your career and involvement with mergers and acquisitions, and it's a proven fact that 70, 75% plus of them overpay. And, you know, that makes transaction bumpy down the road. But in your looking back on some of those, where do you see them really failing to, other than what you've already mentioned, where are they really failing in terms of legal issues, financial issues, et cetera? Where is that overpayment coming from, and how do we avoid that?
Overpayment. We'll focus on that number first, or that idea. Let's go to what's happening right now, and then we'll move back in history a little bit. Right now, the focus is on, quote, value. Okay. And I know we've always heard about that, and we've heard about it for years, but especially small businesses tend to just say, oh, it'll add great value to our company, without understanding what that is and where the hidden value is. Typically, the value's been in top line. They make $40 a month. Okay, we only make 30. That means we're going to make 70 together. Okay, well, the math doesn't exactly work that way. That's one. But two, it's not where the value is. The value isn't in top line. And even if you boil this down to margins, say their margin is 3%, my margin is 2%, now we're going to have at least a 5% margin. Okay, and that still doesn't work. So where is the hidden value in the other company, and how can we find that? If there are operationally things that a buyer does that a seller needs, and they can take that certain technology or human capital in order to plug in specific needs that lead to specific efficiencies and that can translate into dollars, now you've dug a little bit deeper into where that value is. It could be that one company has an analyst that is just crazy good. One way of unlocking that would be grabbing data from one company, giving it to that data company B's analyst, and say, what would you do with this? And then you test to see where that particular analyst's skills and talents can improve company A. Now you've dug deeper, and you can really see where that person has some great value. And you can do the same thing with systems. And you say, let's plug in your manufacturing system or your sales training system and apply it to us. And then you see where that real value is. If you identify where that value is, then you can really see where value in a company is and where there may very well be the dreamed synergy, the synergy that the CEOs just think that are there because that's what they want to imagine, right? Sure. Okay. And there's a big movement to that now. And I think that's only going to get greater as inflation keeps going and, you know, and all of that, and, you know, prices and valuations have to be done a little differently. That's what's happened now. Historically, why do they overpay? Because they don't know how to find the value that I just described. They just look at top line dollars, and sometimes they'll look at bottom line numbers, but they won't look at the reasons behind that. Other reasons are they just don't look around corners. They don't see what's coming. And those are the kinds of due diligence things that have to take place now.
So what I'm hearing you saying, and maybe you could expand upon that a little bit, is looking at the underpinnings of both the cost and the income side of the thing and see where the hidden values are, the relationships, the likelihood of those to continue, et cetera.
And you have no idea what's going on underneath those multiples.
Yeah.
And have no idea if the financials are even close to being right. And 99 times out of 100, they're wrong. And they're usually wrong because the owners don't know how to verify their accuracy.
Yeah, well, and the other thing underpinning what you're talking about is the whole arena of what is the likelihood of the current or even 3 years worth of trailing earnings, what's the current earnings, and what's the likelihood of that to continue? In other words, what are the component pieces? And that's just devastating not to do that. And to your comment about the financials, I mean, you can always get audited financials, but usually the smaller companies don't have them. And then you're looking at sometimes $30,000, $40,000 more expense to get a set of audited financials that go back for a while.
You know, looking at tax returns and K-1s, that doesn't really tell the whole story.
Right.
And they each have their own CPAs, and their CPAs all have different ideas, and CFOs have different ideas of how you book things. And you know, they're all right, or they're all legitimate, I assume. But you just have to figure out what that is and if that fits your business model as well.
Do they come to you seeking advice before they are ready to execute on one of these things? Or do they see you as somebody who's going to help them transact and it's moving forward no matter what?
It's both. I really like the ones that they come and ask me about first, because then we can have this kind of a conversation. And that's always very rewarding for me as a counselor. More often than not, the feedback's been positive from the clients, and that is, I'm glad that we spoke. I have a lot of things now to think about. If they decide to go through it, I get to be part of that transaction, the counseling stages, right from the very beginning. You know, talk to them about, and then we go through all those communication issues, cultural issues, and all that. These other people call me up and say, look, I've got a deal going. I'm buying the widget company down the street. It's $40. Just write it up and we're done. We already have the deal. We're going to close in a month. Just not that much, not that big a deal. Just write it up. Just give it to me. Okay. No, that's what you want. You know, I see deal points and I just ask. I just want to confirm. Yep, that's what we got. Every one of us has a different personality, and we carry that personality with us through everything we do, through our day-to-day socialization in our family and out in business and to our employees and to our colleagues in business. And that's just who we are.
As you're working with people, do you find that they have accurately assessed the time and resources and money that it's going to take to achieve this magical dream that they have of what they get at the end of this?
Most of those questions are, how much is this going to cost me and your fee? To that extent, yes. But then there's the follow-up. What about your time? What do you estimate your time to be? And who else in your organization are you going to ask? And what does that take away from their revenue generation, et cetera? For the most part, everybody underestimates the lost opportunity impact in their organization, because there's a lot to do, especially on the financial side, because what's the most important thing in one of these deals? And that's the money. So if I'm the seller, I need financials. Now, chances are my financials are not up to date, and they need a little bit of tweaking before I give them to my potential buyer. So who am I going to ask to do that? Okay, I'm going to ask my bookkeeper, my CFO. That takes a lot of time. If I'm the buyer, when I get those adjusted financials, I now have to give them to my CFO or my CPA, who I have to pay out of pocket, to validate, question, and analyze those numbers. I now go to my salespeople and say, so tell me what your projections are for the next year. And that cost is lost. Nobody ever thinks about all of that. And all of those are all disruptions, and that costs money.
Once all that's squared away, you still have to integrate these two organizations somehow and get everybody to play nice.
Right.
And I loved your example of the IT systems change. No one that I've ever experienced has accurately estimated the amount of time and energy and money it's going to take to make that work. It's a great example of fabulous sales and marketing, because it's always, you put this in and your problems are solved. We talk about what it's going to deliver when it's all said and done, but it's never said and done.
Things cost more. It takes longer. It's harder to get the contractor and everybody engaged and in place.
The other problem that leadership faces, starting with the business owner, is who to involve and when in their organization in this process. Is there going to be a systems match? And if not, and it never is, what's the integration going to take? And so who do you involve in this and when? And again, that goes back to what your culture is. You have to handle that situation very delicately. If your company is strong enough and they can handle, you know, the individuals can handle the thought of that they're going to be sold and merged with so-and-so, great, then do it. But if they can't, if they're in the same industry, then they're going to start talking. Now you got a real problem.
I was talking with someone last week who's on the slightly less than equal side of an acquisition, or looked like a merger. There was a lot of great talk about, we're going to learn from this other company. We're going to take what they do well. And now they're, you know, in the process of telling the other company, yeah, forget about that stuff. We're going to learn from you. Start doing it our way. 9 months since the acquisition, they've spent a lot of time, almost like 3 months, arguing in meetings about which expense report form they should use.
Oh, boy.
And as an outsider, I look at it and go, well, you got three choices. You guys do it our way, or we'll start doing it your way, or we come up with a totally new way. And they've spent at least 3 months in meetings after meeting, arguing about that. And as a result, by the way, just a side note, a tremendous amount of really key people have left. The reason I ask that question is, in your example, they make 40, we make 30, we'll jam them. All we got to do is sign the paper and we get 70. Or all I got to do is get a good contractor and voila, I get the outcome I wanted. But we don't buy process. Or we don't think about the process. And I, just another side note, there used to be a commercial that was running years ago. They said, what if everyone told the truth? And they had a contractor saying, okay, it's going to take a lot longer than you think. And there's going to be times when I disappear for 3 weeks. Don't even try and find me. but when we're all done, you're going to kiss me full on the lips. They're thinking about what it's going to be when it's all done, but not the road here to there.
Right.
Going to be arduous. What's driving the need to merge or acquire a company? Yeah. What is it that you want? And is there another way to get it internally without buying this thing?
I have that conversation with them all the time, because it's critical that I know that, what the motivation is, because that's the real interest. And the deal has to satisfy that interest. And if there's something behind it, it's far easier to make that deal work. Because then the client has acknowledged, this is the priority point. I need this. And if I get this, everything else I can deal with. So now we know how to play the chips. Give up that chip, you're getting the big chip.
It's easier to, not easy, but easier to determine the true cost. I can put $50 toward the acquisition, or I could put that $50 towards an organic solution to get what it is I want.
That's correct. Yeah. And one of the things too that you have to be aware of when you're going into one of these transactions is what happens if it doesn't work. If you just never sign a deal. You know, you spend 2 or 3 months working through these things. You've got yourself an LOI. And, you know, I see LOI terms change all the time. So that's it. We're done. Question is, what's the impact on the industry? Your standing in the industry. That's something you have to be careful about. And the situation that rolls into the example you were just talking about, where three of the people aren't there anymore. And my question is, did they go to a competitor? And that's always a problem. And I don't want to seem overly negative about these things and pessimistic about these deals, because they do go through. A lot of them actually get signed, and then there's still work to do after the deal is signed to actually get the closing done.
And by the way, in that example, the people did go to a competitor.
Oh, really?
Or an organization that will be someday. Non-compete agreements. Now, I've heard that those are not enforceable legally if you're willing to go to court and do, you know, spend all the money to beat it. Is that an inaccurate portrayal on my part?
It depends.
Excellent consulting answer, by the way. Is it different from state to state? Is it?
So it does. It depends on, that's the answer I got to give you. Yes, it's dependent upon state to state, and it depends on federal law as well, because some of these are going to be governed by federal law. The floating factors are the industry, the job, the length of time involved, and the geography. You got to balance all of those factors in there, and then the degree of non-compete. Having said that, the reason you see them in there is for deterrence. Okay? And they are very effective as deterrents.
It just comes up a lot in mergers and acquisitions. That's why I took you down a little side trail there. I was just
quite all right. We deal with those all the time.
We all have talked about this huge percentage of M&As that really don't work. And then the ones that do take more time and money than what they expected. And David, you mentioned how you prefer when they come to you first and say, well, what do you think? Well, that's exactly what success authorities in that window is for as well, to help them match it up right and get prepared and make sure it's the right thing to do.
That's a great service.
For the sake of argument, as opposed to the dark side of M&A, what do you see as the bright side of M&A?
The successful deals are those run by executives who are able to find solutions towards a mutually beneficial goal. That part I really like. If I'm working with another lawyer of the same mindset, my counterpart has the same attitude as my client's counterpart, where they're really focused on the deal, and then it's fun. Then it's really a matter of linguistics to accurately reflect the party's intents and their mutual goals. When you get one of these done, at first it's just a big relief. Finally got this done, but now we get to go forward with this new gig. What do? Well, we go back to all the things that we talked about doing, and now you get to implement those because now you've planned all those things out. That part's really great. And when you see one of these things succeed, it's gratifying.
Look forward to future podcasts featuring authorities on topics vital to the success of your business during these changing times. For more information and to contact us directly, visit successauthorities.com.